All right. Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host, Ron Meniza, is away today. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. That's radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram, at Fran Storch ND. So here's a bunch of cool topics for you today. The first one we're going to go after is, what's the difference between the repertory and the materia medica? It's more homeopathy stuff. Okay, so a repertory is a book or a compilation of some sort, and it lists off all of the homeopathic remedies alphabetically. So I got that backwards. Oh my goodness. So the repertoire is very interesting. So let's get back to basics. Materia medica is what I just said. The materia medica is a book or a compilation where it lists off the homeopathic remedies alphabetically and tells you everything that those homeopathic remedies might be able to help you with. The repertory is the reverse of that. It's a list of symptoms, and all of the symptoms are listed, and it tells you which homeopathic remedies can help you with those symptoms. So they're sort of, mirror images of each other, or sort of opposites or complementary, however you might say it. So a materia medica, if you were to receive a materia medica, there's some famous materia medicas. There's the Kent has a materia medica, and there are numerous homeopaths who have written great materia medicas. There's compilations of materia medicas that combine different great homeopathic authors who have done different materia medicas. And so there was Boricke. We used to use Boricke. We used to use more modern ones. There was Sankaran. So there was Muir. There was Clark. There was Allen. There's a lot of different ones, and then some of them are compilations. If we were to read a materia medica, it would start from the beginning with homeopathic remedies that began with A, and would list various homeopathic remedies alphabetically. Depending on the materia medica that you get, it might have more or less remedies in it. There are very very intricate ones that have very what we call small remedies in them. So when you have homeopathic remedies, first of all, just to back up, homeopathy is the study of remedies, specific remedies that have been diluted and potentized in a specific way so they can help you tune into your own ability to heal yourself. And they basically tune you into a frequency for a particular purpose. And homeopathic remedies can be given based on your constitution. That means based on how you are in general, your personality, what illnesses you tend to get, what disease states you may have. It can also be given based on a particular disease state. So if you have, for example, if you're constipated, there's a few remedies that tend to help with constipation, but you have to fit the specific symptoms of that remedy's constipation. So if you need homeopathic Nux Vomica, the symptoms that go along with Nux Vomica are different than the symptoms that would go along with homeopathic Illumina, which are different from the symptoms that would go along with homeopathic Calcarb. So, for example, homeopathic Nux Vomica, you would tend to really want to go to the bathroom, but you just can't. You tend to be really stressed out, high-strung, competitive, got a lot of deadlines, use a lot of substances to keep yourself going. And if you get nauseated, you tend to feel better if you get sick. So that's Nux Vomica. If you're really stressed out and intense and competitive place pushing yourself to keep going, that would be Nux Vomica. Illumina is really, really bad constipation where your stool's really dry and you just can't get it out, and you even feel like you have to reach in there and get it out. I know that's kind of gross, but that's homeopathic Illumina. Very dry stool, really, really intractable constipation. And homeopathic Calcarb, you want to see a sluggishness, a slowness. The person might be hypothyroid. The person tends to be mistrustful of people when they first meet them. But the big thing you want to see with that constipation is you want to see just there's a slowness and a sluggishness to the whole system, quite different from your next vomica presentation. There isn't necessarily the dryness that you see. In fact, people who need Calcarb are going to tend to be on the damp side. They're going to tend to have swelling and dampness in their body, and they're going to tend to feel worse from dampness and damp weather. So as you can see, it's all different. And so if you were to look in the Materia Medica under those different homeopathic remedies, they would list off those symptoms. And when you look at a Materia Medica, it's going to list the different homeopathic remedies. And when you see a particular homeopathic remedy, for example, Nux Vomica, you're going to see the different categories where they tell you about what the remedies do. So there'll be a category for generals, there'll be a category for mind, there'll be a category for your skin, for your gastrointestinal, for your urinary tract. Some Materia Medicas have every single physical category listed, and some of them have only a few or only the particular ones for that remedy, depending on how extensive the Materia Medica is. The more modern ones with fewer remedies in them, if they're just sort of a guidebook, they might not have as many categories. Where a combined Materia Medica that borrows from a lot of different classical Materia Medicas are going to have every single category. They'll finish off with remedies that are complementary to that remedy. So, for example, if you take a particular remedy and then you take another remedy along with it, you'll have a good result. You might have a list of follows well. So if you take a particular homeopathic remedy, another remedy might be helpful if you use it after using that remedy. So for example, if you use Nux Vomica first and you get the person calmed down, they might go then into another constitutional state. So they might need homeopathic phosphorus, and they may follow each other well. Then you have remedies that are inimical that you shouldn't use together, if you use them together, they don't work well together. You might get an aggravation, which means you get a strengthening of symptoms, or you might prove the remedy, which means you're going to get symptoms of the remedy that it's supposed to take care of. And then you might have a list of comparisons. So for example, in terms of the constipation, you might see listed under Nux Vomica, Nux Vomica could be compared to Calcarb because of the constipation, as well as Illumina. You might see those in the list. So they're remedies that have similar characteristics. So when you go through the Materia Medica, what you're going to have is a book full of listings of specific homeopathic remedies and what they do for you. You can have Materia Medicas for other systems. So you can have a Materia Medica for herbal remedies. So it's going to be a book that lists specific herbs and all the different things that the herbs do. You can also have a Materia Medica for flower essences. So those are going to be flowers that have been extracted in water, and the Materia Medica for the flower essences is going to, FES, Flower Essence Services, makes a flower essence repertory. It's one book, and it's both a Materia Medica and a repertory. So it's not as extensive as the homeopathic repertories in Materia Medicas, but it does list off all the different flowers and how they can help you. And then after that, there's a listing of different emotional states or different emotional states, and some of them are physical states as well, but mostly for flower essences, you're working with emotional states, and it's going to list off the different remedies that help various emotional states and the specifics on how they'll help those emotional states. So that would be the repertory. So the repertory, one of the most famous ones is the Kent's repertory. There are other repertories. And I just remembered one of the Materia Medicas that I like to use. I like to use the Concordant Materia Medica because it is a compilation of Kent and Boricke and other famous homeopaths that wrote their own Materia Medicas, and they're compiled in that. So the repertories, there's Kent and Boricke. There's also the there's a synthetic repertory where it synthesizes a bunch of different repertories into one. And so the repertory is very interesting. Repertories usually have tabs, and the tabs might just be printed. So if you look at the side of the book, where the pages are, you can see little black marks where the tabs are. Sometimes they have indented tabs, and it'll say on it what the tabs are for. And the tabs are for the different body systems where you're going to be looking for your symptoms. So it's very interesting. So say you go into the mind tab. So you open up mind, and inside mind, you're going to have a lot of different mind states. So for example, you go down, you'll have mind anxiety. And under anxiety, there might be some generals, so all of these remedies that help anxiety. The homeopathic remedies that help anxiety will be listed as 1, 2s, and 3s. How they are listed is the homeopathic remedies that are 3s, a homeopathic remedy that's a 3 is very likely to help the condition that you're looking at. Homeopathic remedy that's a 2 in the listing is somewhat likely to help the condition, and the homeopathic remedy that's a 1 is less likely to help it. It's less likely to be the right remedy, but it has been seen to help it. So it could be in the list. So if you go under mind anxiety, you're going to have a huge list of remedies that help anxiety. It's not going to be a very useful rubric for you. So each of the symptoms, the specific symptoms that are listed for the homeopathic remedy, they're called rubrics. And a rubric is a very specific symptom that is associated with a particular homeopathic remedy or particular homeopathic remedies. So the more specific you can get your rubric, the more likely you are to find a remedy that's going to help the person with that, whatever they have going on. So if you have mind anxiety, lots of remedies help anxiety. But if you have mind anxiety, the next thing you'll generally have is times of day. So morning, evening, the middle of the night, different times of day, you'll have the anxiety. And then you'll have more, after you get through the times of day, then you'll have mind anxiety and specific things that cause anxiety. So mind anxiety while driving a car. Mind anxiety while playing the piano. I'm not kidding. Mind anxiety during a headache. Mind anxiety while sleeping. Well, sleeping might be a time of day thing. Mind anxiety that insects will crawl on her. Really, some of the remedies can be very strange, and you can be very creative about how you use your rubrics. So if a person is anxious, but you have another really specific symptom that they have, like mind or that you have, they have pain, for example. So if you go to, if you're going to have pain, you're gonna want the location of the pain. So say they have abdominal pain, you're gonna want to go to the abdomen tab. You open up abdomen pain, periumbilical, and you know, like knives, for example. So you get real specific with that. And then you might find a really specific homeopathic remedy for that symptom. And then if the person also happens to be anxious, then you go back. And even though that there's lots and lots of remedies that can help anxiety, you want to just make sure that that remedy, even though the rubric is very large, you want to make sure that that remedy covers anxiety as well. And if you have that, really specific symptom, but you know the person is anxious and you check to see if the remedy will help anxiety, then you're all set. Then you want to give that remedy. So it's kind of interesting. So the homeopathic, if you're a homeopath, you're going to be wanting to use your materia medica as well as your repertory. And before there was internet, if you studied homeopathy, you had lots and lots of books, because you can never have too many books when you study homeopathy. And I still reach for my actual physical books in homeopathy. Now that there's internet, I may look up certain homeopathic remedies on the internet. There are internet materia medicas and repertories, and there are even repertory programs. When I was in school a million years ago, they were already putting together repertory programs. So you could repertorize, you could take the person's homeopathic case where you interview the person and you find out all of their different symptoms about different conditions. And then you could pop those symptoms into a computer program and it will do an algorithm for you and you'll find a homeopathic remedy that way. And of course, at that time, there were people who argued that you don't want to use a computer program, that you have to interview the person, you have to use your intuition, and that you're going to be able to synthesize something for the person by getting to know them better than a computer program is going to. However, of course, as we know, with anything, any kind of testing, any kind of program, any kind of app, any kind of lab value, they're tools. They're useful tools. In the end, as a clinician, you have to make your own decision. And if you're a good clinician, you're also going to interact with your patient and you're going to talk to them about it, if whether this feels right to them and if they even want to do it. So all of these can be really, really, really helpful. So with homeopathy, there can be contention about whether you should use books, whether you should use the computer, whether and how you should come to the remedy that you should use. There is also classical versus drainage type of homeopathy. So classical homeopaths are only, they're always like, you should only use one homeopathic remedy at a time because you're tuning the body into that particular frequency at that time and you don't want it to be distracted by other frequencies. And then there's the camp of people who do drainage. And drainage is where you combine various homeopathic remedies for a particular purpose. And that's a whole science unto itself. And the idea is that when you combine these homeopathic remedies, they're going to cause the body to release toxins or substances that it no longer needs and or to move fluid or energy through a particular system in a particular way. And, you know, there's argument about which one you should use. I am really of the whatever works school of thought. So if you need homeopathic medicine, I'll give you the right remedy. If you need a drainage remedy, I'm willing to do that. If you need an herb, great. If you need stress reduction, and you probably do, I'm going to work with you on that. So as a naturopathic physician, my practice is very eclectic, which means that I like to use lots of different things to help the person. I want to put the person together with the thing that's going to help them heal, whatever that is, whoever that is, wherever that is. I am not attached to any one way of helping a person. I am attached to helping a person the way that that person needs help, whatever that happens to be. If you look at me and you say, I don't believe in homeopathy, it can't work, I'm not going to use it, I guess what I'll say to you? Okay, let's find something else for you and I'll find out what you are willing to work with. Because, you know, that I have respect for that. If you have a thing where you're not into homeopathy can be hard to wrap your brain around because not everybody believes in the idea of like cures like. And there are major detractors of this idea that like cures like. And the idea that something that's been diluted and potentized beyond the level of the presence of a molecule in the substance, there are people who feel like that can't possibly work. So I use homeopathy because I've seen it work. If it didn't work, if it never worked, I wouldn't use it. I'm very pragmatic that way. I don't have judgments about it doesn't make sense to me, so it shouldn't work. If something has been shown to work, I don't care what it is. It's okay with me. If it's not harming the person, I'm going to use it. And so I don't have a judgment about it shouldn't work. It's non-scientific. It's unproven. When I see that things work, I'm likely to use them. If they usually don't work and they can help harm people, I'm not going to use them. So it helps to be, to not be judgmental that way, to be and to be open-minded as to what is going to help people. So it's very interesting if you ever want to check out a homeopathic repertory or homeopathic materia medica to see how interesting that they're really fascinating, because when you give homeopathy, you're not just giving it, okay, this person has a stomach ache, so I'm going to give them a remedy for a stomach ache. No, you're going to give them for a very specific stomach ache. They have a stomach ache where they feel like there's bugs crawling inside their stomach, or they feel nausea, but they can't get sick and they wish they could, or They have a stomach ache where the pain is mostly felt epigastrically. They have a stomach ache where the pain is felt around the umbilicus. They have a stomach ache where it's in the inguinal region, you know, in the crease between your leg and your abdomen. So there's so many different things that you want to find out. And one of the things that homeopathy teaches us in naturopathic medicine is to be a really good interviewer. So you, even if you're not necessarily going to give the patient a homeopathic remedy, you're going to ask them a lot of questions and you're really going to find out what's going on with them. And so having really good interviewing skills is very useful for any sort of clinician, and homeopathy just really helps you to be very specific with that, whether you use a homeopathic remedy or not. So really interesting stuff. All right, so that was interesting, the difference between the homeopathic materia medica and the repertory. Hope you found that interesting. Okay, now I would like to talk about ovarian cysts. Ow. Why? Because a patient that I have helped who had ovarian cysts a few years ago called me back and has another one. And I thought to myself, you know what? This is something that women get. Obviously, this is not something you guys have to worry about, except when you're caring for that woman you love who has got that ovarian cyst. So let's talk about ovarian cysts because it's a fairly common condition. Lots of women get it. It hurts. It can be not very serious. It can be moderately serious. But we're talking about a cyst now that is not cancer. Ovarian cancer is another issue that we may discuss at another time. But this is specifically ovarian cysts. Ovarian cysts are usually harmless. They can go away on their own. They can get really big and rupture. They can really hurt. That's the big thing, that they can be really painful. And if they're very, very big, they can move your reproductive organs around, and they can push things out of the way. They can also move your bowels out of the way. That can be a really big problem. So then, you know, doctors may want to go in and get them out if they don't go away on their own. Some women tend to get a lot of them. Some women never get them. Me, Fran, I don't know if I've ever had one. When I used to get my period, I don't get my period anymore. I'm old. So, I'm not getting ovarian cysts. I'm not getting ovarian pain. I'm not getting anything there anymore. I don't know if I ever had one. I do know that in my cycling life, not in my bicycling life, but my fertility cycling life, I did get Mittelschmerz at times. What is Mittelschmerz, you may ask? Mittelschmerz is a German word that means pain in the middle. So pain in the middle is when you get pain when you ovulate. Ow. So why would you get pain when you ovulate? Well, you should see what ovulation actually looks like. If you ever watched a video of what ovulation looks like, it's pretty dramatic. What happens is you have FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. It comes from your pituitary gland, and it stimulates your follicles to grow. So follicles are these little encapsulations on your ovary that contain the cells that are going to become, ultimately, to become an ovum, an egg cell. So when your FSH kicks in at the beginning of your cycle, these follicles start to grow, and they grow and grow and grow. And eventually, when one gets big enough, the LH comes in, luteinizing hormone, and says, all right, you're big enough, and it zaps one of them. And the winner, the biggest one, ruptures. It breaks open, and it kicks out an ovum. It kicks out a little egg cell. And then the fimbria, the little fingers at the end of your fallopian tube, they start waving and they draw the little egg cell into the fallopian tube. Goes into the fallopian tube, it travels down, and then the fallopian tube is attached to the uterus, and then it goes into the lining of the uterus. And if you happen to have sex, and you know, with the intention of conceiving, sperm might reach that ovum, and then you conceive. And then after about 12 days, the little zygote becomes an embryo. When the egg and the sperm fuse together, they are now a zygote. And then when they get big enough, they become an embryo. And about 12 days into that process, you have nidation. And nidation means nesting. That's when the ovum, when the little embryo burrows into the lining of the uterine wall, and now you're pregnant. That happens. Now, if you don't get fertilized, then, and so the other thing that happens is you've ovulated, right? So you have this follicle that's split in two. So you have half as many cells in the ovum as you, or half as many chromosomes, sorry, in the ovum as you do in every cell in your body, so that it can join with a sperm, which also has half as many chromosomes, and they come together, and then they make, now you're back to having a full 46 chromosomes. And so the other half stays back in the ovary and becomes a corpus luteum. Corpus luteum is very important because it sits there and makes progesterone for you. And progesterone is super important for all kinds of things. But the main thing it's important for when you ovulate is to get your uterine lining ready for implantation. That's what it's for. The other neat thing that it does right at that time is it tells all the other follicles that were developing to go back to sleep. It is an anti-proliferative hormone, and it is really, really important. And this is why, one reason women have PMS, because they don't have enough progesterone, because estrogen causes too much growth. It causes, it causes growth. So if you have an imbalance and you don't have enough progesterone, you're going to have excessive growth, which means you're going to have swelling, you're going to have irritability, you're going to have achiness, and you're not going to be as calm. And progesterone is responsible for giving pregnant women that lovely glow and making you feel kind of chill. It's really a nice hormone, I must say. And unfortunately, progesterone is very easily converted to cortisol because nature wants you to either be gestating a baby or running away from danger. Nature basically wants you to survive. So it's either going to have you survive by making a new little you or by running away from danger, but it doesn't want you to do both. So the brilliant thing is that progesterone is either going to sit there and help you to conceive and maintain a pregnancy, or it's going to be converted to cortisol so you can run away from danger. Because if you are endangered, you're not going to be able to have a baby anyway. So we might as well turn all your progesterone into cortisol so you can't be pregnant. You're going to be more able to run away from danger if you're not pregnant. So that's an interesting thing, that the way that goes. So how does this turn into an ovarian cyst? So ovarian cysts, what happens is ovarian cysts can happen. Just a very simple ovarian cyst can happen if you have an estrogen progesterone imbalance. So what you'll have is you'll have follicles developing, and you have a follicle that just doesn't ovulate, and it just keeps growing and growing. So if you tend to be estrogen dominant, that's more likely to happen. And it'll just keep growing and growing, and it tends to be painful. And then if it eventually ruptures, that can hurt too. And you're going to get pain because when you have rupturing, you're going to spill the contents of the ovum, which can include some blood, into your abdominal cavity. And your abdominal cavity doesn't like that. That causes inflammation and irritation, and so it causes pain. So that's part of what happens. The cyst itself, it will tend to only hurt if it's pressing on something, but when it ruptures, then it can cause pain. But if it's pressing on something, or if it's pressing on a nerve, or if there's some nerve communication with your low back, you can get pain. I misspoke. I said that I can't get an ovarian cyst, but it's not true. I can theoretically get one. It's not usual, but it's more likely to happen in a woman of childbearing years, because the way it happens is because one of your follicles overgrows. So two really common cysts are, like, the one I just described is basically a follicular cyst. And the follicular cyst is so when you're about to ovulate, like I said, instead of ovulating, it just keeps growing and growing, and you don't ovulate and it just makes it a cyst. You can also get a corpus luteum cyst. So remember how I said when you ovulate, half of your egg goes into half of your follicle turns into an egg, and the other half becomes the corpus luteum and makes progesterone for you. Well, the corpus luteum can decide to grow and grow and grow also. And it seals off and it doesn't involute like it's supposed to. And it just accumulates fluid and it becomes cystic as well. So that's another interesting way that you can get a cyst. And those are really common, usually uncomplicated cysts. But that's another kind of cyst. you can get other more unusual cysts. You can get a cyst adenoma, and it's not actually from a follicle. So the two cysts I just described are the most common kind. The most common kind is the follicular cyst. And because if women who get these repeatedly, they're like, oh, I have an ovarian cyst again, because the cyst is going to cause some inguinal pain, some pain in your lower abdomen on the side. The follicular cyst, follicular cysts are probably the most common, and so corpus luteum cyst is a little less common. You're going to see that as well. So they have to do with the production of the follicle, and they're more likely to happen because every month you're growing these follicles, and hormones are stimulating the follicles to grow. So every month you have the chance of this happening. The other more rare kinds of cysts, you can get a cyst adenoma. Cyst adenoma is just made from ovarian tissue, not from a follicle. And so it's like you can get a cyst anywhere else. You can get a cyst on your skin. You can get a cyst on your mucous membrane. You get a cyst in your mouth. You get a cyst anywhere in your body. This is where you get a cyst on your ovary that's not from a follicle. So it's made from an ovarian gland, and it can be full of fluid, mucus, stuff like that. You can also get dermoid cysts. So dermoid cysts are very straight. They're unusual. They usually are not cancerous, but they can be. And they're very strange. And there's a theory that dermoid cysts are, they're usually an identical twin that never developed. And just so that your body tried to the way you make an identical twin is, like we said, you ovulate and you create the ovum, and then an identical twin would happen where once the egg is fertilized, the egg is fertilized by one sperm. One egg is fertilized by one sperm, and then if you're going to have identical twins, instead of just starting to continually double in size and replicate chromosomes, it undergoes another meiosis. Maybe it's a mitosis, because it's now fertilized. It has 46 chromosomes, and then it undergoes a mitosis where it splits and it doubles itself. So you have two zygotes now that have exactly the same genetic profile, and that's how you get identical twins. So if that happens, and that zygote just hangs out in the ovum and doesn't really develop, it can just sit there. And over time, in a woman's life, it can develop human tissue. It can develop hair, teeth, skin, or nails in your ovum. It's very strange. And that theoretically, that's what's been proposed, that this was an identical twin that never developed, but it stays right there in the ovary. There are those that say that that's not exactly how they develop. Then you're just genetically predisposed. And they, when you figure out that that's what you have, they have to be removed. Sometimes the ovary has to be removed with it. They can be cancerous, but they are usually not. Then you can get an endometrioma. So this takes on the idea of endometriosis. So endometriosis is a very unfortunate condition, and I should probably do a whole show on endometriosis, or a whole segment on endometriosis. I'm not going to do that today, but endometriosis is a really tough condition. The woman is predisposed to getting the growth of endometrial tissue, that is the lining of your uterus, growing outside of the uterus. The most common place for it to grow is on the outside of the uterus or on the ovary, but it can extend into the bowel, it can extend into the abdominal wall, it can extend onto other organs. The reason it's problematic is because it is responsive to hormones. So when you get your period every month, you have a uterine lining that grows, and when you have menses, it's because you didn't conceive. And so there's no progesterone. It's the corpus luteum. You get about 2 weeks of progesterone out of the corpus luteum. Then the corpus luteum becomes a corpus albicans, doesn't make progesterone anymore. There's nothing to maintain the uterine lining. And you get your menses. And that's what happens. And so if you have endometriosis, that means you have uterine lining that's sitting outside of the uterus. So the uterine lining is not encapsulated in the confines of the uterine lining, and then into the vagina, and then out the body. You have uterine tissue that's sitting on the outside of the uterus, on the ovary, could be on the bowel. And guess what? It's sensitive to hormones just like the uterine lining is. So progesterone will cause it to grow and ripen just like if there was going to be an implantation there. And then when the progesterone involutes from the, when the progesterone goes away because the corpus luteum involutes goes away because it's done and you haven't conceived, you get your menses and you get the menses out of the endometrial tissue that's outside of your uterus, and it spills right into your abdominal cavity. And the abdominal cavity does not like having free blood or free fluid in it. And it's very irritating and it causes inflammation. You get antibodies, your body just goes haywire. And so endometriosis is very, very painful. And so it's something that really, that, like I said, it's something that is worth talking about. I can talk to you about more about like how many people have endometriosis and what causes it and how to treat it naturally. So an endometrioma would be a cyst on your ovary that's filled with endometrial tissue. And when you get your period, it's going to leak and it's going to bleed and it's going to be very painful. So the way you treat that is the way that you treat endometriosis. So the three above, the dermoid and the cystadenoma and the endometriosis, can actually damage the ovary, and it can cause twisting. It can give you scar tissue. It could cause adhesions, and you may become infertile in that ovary, unfortunately. There's also polycystic ovarian syndrome. Again, that's a whole that's for a whole episode. And polycystic ovarian syndrome is where the ovaries produce lots of different cysts, and the cysts unfortunately produce lots of different hormones. They produce too much estrogen, too much testosterone, too many androgens, and they interfere with a woman's cycle and can make it so that she's less likely to become pregnant, and it can predispose the woman to ovarian cancer. So what can predispose women to ovarian cysts? If you have irregular menses to start with, if you have hormonal imbalances, so if you're estrogen dominant, because you're under a lot of stress or environmental exposures, or you don't eat well, you can have a hormonal imbalance. And it will generally be because you are estrogen dominant. So you have too much estrogen, not enough progesterone, because you need that progesterone to calm the ovaries down. And in fact, one of the treatments for ovarian cysts is to give natural progesterone. When you're hypothyroid, you're more likely to get ovarian cysts, probably because there's a relationship between the functioning of your thyroid and your cycle. Cigarette smoking can cause more ovarian cysts because when you smoke cigarettes, you have more hormonal imbalances, and you actually tend to have lower estrogen, lower hormones altogether. But you have an imbalance where you don't ovulate as much, you're going to have less progesterone, and then you're going to get more cysts. Being obese can also make you have more ovarian cysts, probably because the extra body fat. Body fat is hormonally active, and it makes estrogen. So if you have extra estrogen from having excess weight, you're more likely to get ovarian cysts. You can get ovarian cysts if you have infertility treatments. And so if you have various infertility treatments that cause you to produce lots of follicles, and the drugs that you use during fertility treatments, like clomiphene and seraphine, have been shown to increase the risk for making corpus luteum cysts. Also, if you use tamoxifen, which is a drug that's used after a woman has been treated for breast cancer to block estrogen receptors, tamoxifen has some amphoteric effect, meaning that it can both stimulate and block estrogen receptors. So sometimes you will see the production of ovarian cysts with tamoxifen. How do you know you have ovarian cysts? Well, you might have marked pelvic pain. It can be sharp or sudden, or it can be constant, and it's usually going to be in the inguinal region. So like I said, in that little crease between your thigh and your abdomen, that's where it will tend to hurt. And you could have irregular menses if you don't ovulate during a cycle. So if you know your ovulation, when you ovulate, if you're aware of ovulating, you might get you'll get ovulatory discharge, where you get egg white discharge. And if you don't have that, then you might not have ovulated. So you might have just that cycle, you might have a follicular cyst because you don't actually ovulate when you have it. You might have pelvic pain after with intercourse. So you might be able to feel during intercourse, you might feel pressure against that cyst, and strenuous exercise can cause it too. You might have nausea and vomiting after the rupture of a cyst, just because you're having that rupture is going to cause a lot of pain, and it's going to set off the nerves in that area, and you might it just sets off the signals to the abdomen, and you might feel nauseated. If you could have vaginal pain, and you could have some spotting as well, and you could have pressure and abdominal bloating, and it could have a sidedness to it, and you could also have pain or pressure in your abdomen when you're urinating or having a bowel movement. Also, if you have fertility issues, they can be diagnosed by ultrasound, and usually it's transvaginal, so they have to insert a wand into your vagina to be able to see it. If they're very concerned about the type of cyst that you have, if you get cysts and the pain comes and goes and you have an ultrasound and it's determined to be a follicular cyst, they might just decide to treat you with non-invasive means. But if it's a really big cyst and it's putting pressure on you and you're having a lot of pain, they might decide that you should have laparoscopic surgery to go in and take the cyst, because they may be concerned that it could be a more serious type of cyst, like the endometrioma or the dermoid cyst. And if you can get a CT or MRI if there's concern of more serious things going on. And they might also do a blood test called the CA125. And CA125 is a cancer marker. It's a marker for ovarian cancer, and as well as other cancers, but that they may do that. So the main thing that the MDs do is they give you chemical contraception. That's the main thing that they do. Why do you do that? Because when you have chemical contraception, you don't ovulate. Whether you take a progestin-only pill or you take a mixed estrogen-progesterone pill, that's what's usually done. You probably won't get your ovarian cysts. Now, if you want to have reliable contraception and you're not as concerned about the side effects of chemical contraception, and I say chemical contraception because chemical contraception can be pills, it can be a ring, it can be an implant, it can be a shot. All of those things can be helpful. So that's why I say chemical, not just the pill. But most often women are given contraceptive pills, but you could be given one of those other methods. And because they suppress ovulation, they're going to suppress the growth of cysts. And so you're not going to have the symptoms, but you have to deal with the side effects of chemical contraception. And one of those side effects can be reduced sex drive. It can be atrophy of your reproductive tissue. It can be, you can get blood clots. There are concerns about using chemical contraception. I'm not a huge fan, and yet there are people who are like, they don't want to be bothered. They don't want to use a barrier method. They don't want to count days into their cycle and measure their cervical mucus and things like that. So the easiest thing for them to do for contraception is to take the chemical contraception. There are things that we can do with natural medicine to help prevent you from getting ovarian cysts. One of the foods that I see that tends to promote ovarian cysts is soy. This is one of those cases where soy maybe isn't such a good thing, where the isoflavones stimulate estrogen receptors to the point where women get ovarian cysts from it. Some women get ovarian cysts. The other kind of cyst women get from soy is they get acne. Not all women get acne, and not all women are affected by soy this way. But I have had patients who report that when they eat soy, they get ovarian cysts. If you eat animal protein, and the animal protein has hormones in it, and dairy, the hormones can make you have more ovarian cysts. Being a vegan, quite honestly, will make you have less ovarian cysts as long as you don't eat soy. Also, avoid eating too much stuff in plastic, especially cooking in plastic, because plastic has xenoestrogens in it. And also consider drinking your water from stainless steel or glass bottles, because again, plastic, right? Avoid mineral oil and parabens in your skincare products. Parabens stimulate estrogen receptors. They can lead to ovarian cysts. And use natural detergents. Detergents that you wash clothes with, can cause estrogen like symptoms. Other things that we use for natural medicine. One of the big things we use is progesterone, natural progesterone. If somebody has a lot of ovarian cysts, they may have a progesterone deficiency. I don't like to use this as a first run thing because it is a hormone. And anytime you use a hormone, there is some concern that it can lead to, if the person is susceptible to cancer. I feel pretty safe about natural progesterone, though. I take it myself. And progesterone makes sense because lots of women are progesterone insufficient. Why would this be? Well, guess what? We're stressed out. And what did I say before? Progesterone can easily be converted to cortisol. So if you're in your fight or flight, you're running the kids to school, you have a job, you're in school yourself, you just don't have enough time to rest and relax, your body's going to think you're in fight or flight all the time, and it's going to take the progesterone that you make and turn it into cortisol so you can run away from the bear. But you're not running away from a bear. You're doing your 21st century North American life. So you're going to be progesterone insufficient. And the progesterone's coming from your corpus luteum that you ovulated, and that instead of using it to make a nice lining for a potential baby, you're going to take that progesterone, you're going to turn it into cortisol. It won't be as available to calm you down and to make you less likely to have ovarian cysts. So the less progesterone you have around, the more likely you are to have cysts. So if you use natural progesterone, you're going to tend to be calmer and you're going to tend to make less ovarian cysts. Natural progesterone is not a contraceptive. It won't prevent you from getting pregnant. In fact, it enhances the ability to become pregnant. If you eat a diet that's high in fiber and you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables and clean protein, you're going to have less, you're going to be less estrogen dominant because you're going to be able to excrete your estrogen better. There are certain foods that help you excrete estrogen better. In particular, they would be sesame seeds and chia and flax seeds. Sesame seeds and flax seeds help you to excrete your estrogens better, as do all your cruciferous vegetables, your broccoli, cauliflower, kale, and a lot of your leafy greens, things like that, anything in the mustard family. You can also supplement with the DIM, diindolyl methane, which is a metabolite of I3C. I3C is the compound, indole-3-carbinol, that's in the cruciferous vegetables. It causes more excretion of estrogen. And DIM is a metabolite of that, and you can take that in supplements, and that will help you to excrete more estrogen. There are herbal remedies that can help you to get less ovarian cysts. One of them is chaste tree, Vitex. That's a classic one for ovarian cysts. It's a progesteronic herb. It helps to mimic progesterone, as is wild yam. So why we always think of taking wild yam instead of progesterone. Remember, wild yam is not progesterone. It has a compound in it called diastogen, which can stimulate progesterone receptors, but it is not progesterone. You can convert diastogen to progesterone. But your body can't do it. It's done in the lab, and then it's sold as natural progesterone. So Vitex, chaste tree, and wild yam are the two big ones that I think of. And then there are other things. Dong Quai in general helps to balance both estrogen and progesterone. Black cohosh regulates your entire menstrual cycle. Maca is a neat herb. It's a rainforest herb, but it's a potato. It's not a potato. It's a nightshade. So it's in the nightshade family, and it is a great hormone balancer, and it also is energizing. So any hormonal issue that you have can be helped by maca, whether you're a man or a woman, and whatever your hormonal issue is. Milk thistle seed is going to help because it's going to enhance the functioning of the liver, so you're going to excrete extra hormones more efficiently. And yarrow is something nice that helps to reduce pelvic congestion, and it improves circulation. It works at the level of circulation. If you're bleeding excessively, yarrow is also a good one. And when you actually have a cyst, you can do castor oil packs, and you can soak a flannel in castor oil and put a heating pad over it and put it over the painful spot. So those are a bunch of things that you can do. This is the history of ovarian cysts, how they happen, what they are, some things you can do about it. I hope that was enjoyable for you. I'm going to go. because it's almost time for Bicycle Talk. So, you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza has been away this week. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM. WHUS Stores.